Hi, Steve Pomerantz here, host of On the Money with today's On the Money Extra, where we feature market updates and insights as well as guest interviews with noted financial experts to help you stay informed and learn the facts to make the right decisions about money. So let's get started. The mutual fund industry has changed a lot over the years, and it's not your father's industry anymore. And you know what? That's a good thing. My guest, John Reckenthaler, has been researching the fund industry since 1988. He's now a columnist for Morningstar.com and a member of Morningstar's investment research department. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So it's been a 60-year round trip, in your view, in the world of mutual funds. Mutual funds started out one way, and then they kind of went downhill another, and maybe they've come back up again. What were mutual funds like, in your knowledge, in the 50s or when they first kind of got going?
Yes, when mutual funds began, they were a fairly simple, straightforward concept. They were just basically collections of U.S. stocks or high-quality bonds, or occasionally that great innovation, the balanced fund, which had some stocks and some bonds, two things in one place. But they were pretty straightforward. There was none of the complications that we now have with multiple share classes and 12b1 fees and all this, that sort of thing. And the fees were pretty low. A lot of the fees for the originally actively, they were all actively managed, of course, mutual funds would be like half a percentage point per year, all in expense ratios, even though they were fairly small. So it was a clean, simple, straightforward, cheap product for the most part. As time went on, things got more complicated, right?
Yeah.
New innovation brought to the marketplace. Mutual fund companies trying to stand out. Mutual funds becoming a big deal. And mutual funds became more expensive, more complicated, more gimmicks. And a big sales-driven industry driven by the big brokerage firms. I'm talking, speaking now in the 1980s and into the 1990s. Yeah. For me, that was the nadir, the bottom of the fund industry. Early in the boom.
When you look at the 60s, you know, there were the go-go 60s, the nifty 50, the best, you know, those 50 stocks that, of which probably, you know, only about 48 of those stocks that were the best to buy for the next 100 years are still in business. Then the 70s, and then you had the 80s with declining interest rates and a lot of nonsense that mutual funds went to great lengths to try to sell specialized funds. So it was this kind of greater activity, greater retail participation. And I guess in some way it started to turn into a market where the mutual fund company said, we're not going to grow our assets naturally or organically. We're going to have to get some salespeople out there and really start selling.
Yeah, we're going to drive. The wickedness started in the 60s. See? Not just in the mutual fund industry, apparently, but that's for a different segment. Yeah, it started in the 60s, as you point out, with the performance funds. And before then, the idea was that funds were run mostly by true investment management companies that were kind of quiet places, frankly, that invested money for wealthy people. And they would open up these funds maybe to the less wealthy relatives of those people. But it was a quiet thing, not much advertised. In the 60s, they started to realize if you had a few good years of performance, and this was a hot market, you could start to advertise that and really bring in assets. So as you mentioned, it became more of a sales-driven industry. That got interrupted some in the 70s with the big bear market, but was back in a big time, in a big way in the 1980s when mutual funds took off. And companies, if you started a mutual fund company, you could become wealthy very quickly if you found a way to attract enough assets.
Yeah, and there was a time when a lot of the no-load funds like Vanguard and Fidelity and others, T. Rowe Price, started to advertise directly to the retail investor, and a lot of these funds that were sold by brokers were under pressure because of the big upfront sales charges. I remember, this was before I got into the business, which was in 1981, but mutual fund sales charges could be, I think, something around 7.5% to 8%. They could be paid out over time. I mean, there was some definite schemes, but that initial cost was extremely high. But then you had the no-load funds competing. And so what did the fund companies do kind of undercover to act like no-load funds, but in fact still be load funds?
Yeah, there was the invention of something that's called the 12b1 fee came out circa 1980. And the 12b1 fee is a complicated, messy thing that effectively enables fund companies to take money from existing shareholders so that they can attract new shareholders. Why that helps me as an existing shareholder, I have no idea.
No, it doesn't really.
It's something the SEC should not have agreed to, but it has. And although the SEC doesn't want a 12b-1 fee to exist anymore, they have found it impossible to, you know, put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, we still see it because we still see these B shares.
They're still around.
Yeah, and
but
the C shares.
Using the 12b-1 fee, right, that gets us to the second part of this. There was something invented called a B share, mm-hmm. which was sold by a broker, financial advisor, and the advisor was compensated as if he or she had sold a fund with a front-end load, but it didn't have a front-end load. The fund felt like a no-load fund to people who were buying it. In fact, many investors were fooled, thinking they were not paying a sales charge because they didn't pay anything up front. But in fact, there was this 12b-1 fee of 1 percentage point per year, or sometimes 1.25, that was coming out of their investment year after year after year until the hills crumble and pigs start to fly. I mean, these were perpetual charges.
Perpetual, yeah.
So it was a sales fee that was morphed. And I think that's, for me, that's symbolic of what the industry was like in the 1980s and 90s in many ways, presenting people with something that was otherwise than what it seemed. We have talked a little bit about Putnam High Income, which
mm-hmm.
was a
yeah.
government plus fund in 1980.
Yeah, does anybody listening to this show remember the Putnam government plus funds? You probably don't have a very good memory of that. Tell us quickly about that.
Well, this Putnam High Income fund, government fund, was one of several funds of its ilk that sprung into existence in the mid-1980s. It, mm-hmm. it started business in 1985, I think it was, maybe the start of 1986. Within 2 years, it had gone to $10 billion, which was much larger than Fidelity Magellan at the time. So before it had a track record, it had more money than any stock fund.
Yeah, so what was driving it?
In fact, I think temporarily was the largest fund. Because the fund promised a free lunch. It promised that you would have the safety of government bonds, but better yield than government bonds offered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who could turn that down? You get government bonds, but you get more yield than government bonds.
And don't forget the environment back then. The environment was that interest rates had peaked in 1981, and now we're starting to come down really rather regularly. Your CDs, which had yielded 15%, were then at 12, and then at 10, and then at 8. And these government funds promised to take the government fund, and instead of it having, let's say, an 8% rate of return, it could have a 12% rate of return.
That's right. And of course, it's a little hard for us to imagine now. Only 8%, how can I live on that?
Yeah, exactly.
Such were the times. That's right. They sold yield. And, you know, of course, it wasn't something for nothing. It turned out what these funds were doing. They bought long government bonds. They sold call options against them. They received proceeds from the call options. They passed out these proceeds as if they were dividend or coupon income, although not. They're actually short-term capital gains, mm-hmm. not really income. But it got mixed in there. And then when the bonds, long bonds rallied, their bonds got called away. And when the long bonds didn't rally and fell in price, they were stuck with the losers. And the long and short of it is the fund eroded capital. Its total returns weren't very good. Investors did not realize that they thought they were getting something for nothing, but they were getting something for something. The fund was not what they expected. They bailed, and a few years later, all the funds of that category were out of existence.
Yeah, and they disappeared,
too. That used to happen a lot in the fund industry.
Yeah.
These gimmick funds would come in. They would be bought before they had a track record. As they accumulated a track record, people would realize, wait, this is not what I thought I owned, mm-hmm. and they would bail.
Yeah, at the top of the market in 1999, Merrill Lynch came out with an internet fund. And it, I think in one day it raised $1 billion. I think it was the hottest fund up until that time. And then, of course, you know, it turned out to be a bubble in the internet stocks, and it all crashed and burned. And then just very quietly, that fund just disappeared and got whatever assets were left, which were, I think, were pretty minor, got rolled into other funds. Very difficult to find any information about that old Merrill Lynch internet fund because it just kind of disappears.
Yeah, fund companies, when they bury their dead, they don't put up any signs over their graves. I'm glad you mentioned that fund. One of the things we've learned in following funds over time is often what a fund company doesn't do is as important as what it does do. And in many ways, the definition of a quality of a fund company in the late 1990s was, did they come out with a technology or internet sector fund or not?
Yeah.
And the good actors did not.
Mm-hmm.
They knew exactly what was going on. They knew they could sell a lot of shares and bring in a lot of money, but it was the kind of product that was likely to be you know, purchased by hot money that wasn't fully informed, and very likely there was going to be some sort of reversal in this very volatile sector and disappointed investors.
Yeah, some high-quality funds that are still considered or well-regarded today did not get caught up in all in any of that stuff. They just kept...
Yeah, generally, Vanguard has been very good about resisting temptation.
Right, American funds.
American funds as well,
even though they're sold through brokers mostly, they really kept their shop very clean.
One of the themes in my argument that the fund industry is getting better after going through that bad period is that the best actors have been rewarded. When you look at the largest fund companies in terms of assets, the dominant fund companies, these are the people, the companies that 25 years ago were not doing the things that I'm talking about. And the big fund companies of 25 years ago who thought that they were smarter at the time by having bigger sales forces and coming up with new types of funds and the latest flavors have actually shrunk in assets.
Yeah.
So the good news is investors have been rational.
Mm-hmm.
They've been fooled at times, but they've learned from their mistakes, and they're not responding to the same gimmicks that they responded to a generation ago. So I find it hopeful that people can learn.
Well, you know, there's a lesson for all businesses, and I think the way that we should conduct our own lives is, you know, to do the right thing at all times, and even though it may seem wrong at a certain time because the world is doing something else that you deem to be inappropriate or kind of crazy, if you stick to what you know is right, and, you know, in the case of mutual funds, continue with quality, continue with the idea of stewardship and taking care of your shareholders and the like, you know, it will win out in the end. My guest is John Reckenthaler. He's a member of the Morningstar's investment research team, and he's now a columnist for Morningstar.com. And to find out more about John and hear this conversation again, don't forget to join us at onthemoneyradio.org. John, what effect has the exchange-traded fund or ETF business changed the cost structure of the regular mutual fund?
There's no doubt ETFs have helped to put pressure on the costs of actively managed or open-end fund competitors.
Mm-hmm.
So they've helped ETFs. There are some exceptions, but they tend to be low cost, lower cost than the typical existing mutual fund. And they've been a part of this process whereby investors pay much more attention to costs than they did back in the day. And so the average investor is in a cheaper fund. Now, there are some people who respond, and this is true, by saying, look, it's not necessarily so much that the funds are getting cheaper, it's that investors are refusing to buy the more expensive funds and are rewarding the lower cost funds. So it's not that the industry is getting better.
Oh.
It's that investors are getting better. And to which I respond, fine.
Yeah, either way.
Yeah, I don't care either way. Either way, it's a better result.
Yeah, but the point is you're saying that investors are moving their money to the cheaper funds, but the funds themselves are really not lowering their fees.
The existing funds aren't lowering their fees, but the new funds are cheaper because many of the new funds are ETFs and they're cheaper. So there's truth on both sides of it. It's true that the existing funds are not lowering their fees. I think a lot of these are dinosaur funds. They need to recognize the world has changed, and they're not going to continue to be able to succeed like that. But it's also true new funds coming out do tend to be cheaper.
You know, we use occasionally, for certain kinds of clients, we use money managers. And I remember 20 years ago that the average cost of a money manager was 1%. But it's down below 0.5%, and you know, we're seeing 0.35%. In some cases, 0.15% for a money manager. So I can tell you that in the case of individual, you know, money managers, there is cost pressure. And I think a lot of it, at least from my vantage point, is caused by the fact that there's so much money moving over to index funds.
I think without question, it's interesting that that competition exists with money managers and has really changed the behavior and pricing of the active money managers. That's not happened in mutual funds. The new active mutual funds that come out, there aren't so many of them these days, but when they do, they're not really cheaper than the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
The cheap funds are the index funds, the ETFs are the index. Of course, that's where all the flows are going. So I don't know what some of these active managers are thinking, because they're coming out with new funds that haven't responded to the changes in the environment, and they're not getting assets.
Yeah. Maybe it's very expensive to operate a mutual fund these days, and you need a lot of assets to be able to prorate all of those costs. I mean, you have a lot of legal costs and the like. And also, you know, one of the disadvantages of regular mutual fund are the tax disadvantages. John, last idea, are there any changes afoot to put open-ended mutual funds on the same tax footing as, let's say, index funds or ETFs?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. I don't think that there are any changes. Periodically, we and others will write about our thoughts as to how the tax treatment on funds should change, but I don't believe that's anybody's priority in Washington. They have other priorities, some of which are useful, maybe some less so. But
okay. All right.
That's also for a different discussion, right?
Yeah, exactly. My guest, John Reckenthaler, columnist for Morningstar.com and a member of Morningstar's investment research team, and we had a pretty good discussion about the current state of mutual funds. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
A pleasure. Hope to talk with you another time.
You're listening to On the Money with certified financial planner Steve Pomerantz. If you'd like information about guests, topics, or anything you hear on this program, call 866-MONEY01 or visit the show's website at onthemoneyradio.org.